So at this time, brothers and sisters, we are ready to begin our second class. Our speaker is Brother Roger Lewis. The theme for Brother Lewis's classes this week is the future restoration of Israel. And today's class is entitled, I Will Make in the Wilderness a Way.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my brothers and sisters. I'm really only concerned that my critical mass is here, but I'm glad you're all able to join me as well. So as our chairman has announced, our study this morning is on the matter of I will make in the wilderness a way. And you might remember that in our study yesterday, we did travel with the House of Israel as they went through the wilderness of the peoples. A reference to how the papacy has scorched the earth into a dry and arid land. And the center of that desert place we found is Europe, where the harlot sits. And it's more than just spiritually barren, it's the waste and howling wilderness of hostile enemy territory. And we saw how Elijah is going to congregate the Jewish people into that wilderness and bring them into the bonds of the covenant, just as Moses did of old. And we also saw how the trials of that journey will take its toll upon many, as Yahweh uses the experience of that journey to purge out the rebels from his people, but also to bring the remnant that are left to the fullness of faith. Do you know, when we consider the first Exodus, we realize that although there were only 11 days from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea, so says Deuteronomy 1 verse 2, that in fact the children of Israel wandered in that wilderness for how long? 40 years, we're told, until all the rebels were purged, as Numbers 14 verse 33 tells us. And I think we've got reason to believe that that epoch of probation, 40 years, will be the same period during which the house of Israel will wander in the wilderness of the peoples. In other words, the time period of the first Exodus will become the template for the second. Now, there's a biblical basis for making that assumption. In Numbers 14, as we've just said, your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years. Psalm 95, verse 10 says, 40 years long was I grieved with this generation. And Acts 13, verses 17 and 18 says, the God of this people brought them out of Egypt, and about the time of 40 years suffered he their manners in the wilderness. So that's the first Exodus. But you might know of this passage in the book of Micah, chapter 7, verse 15, that speaking of the second Exodus says, according to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt, will I show unto him marvelous things. Now, in the Hebrew, you'll notice that that phrase, according to the days, is just one Hebrew word, kimi. But that word is not just a word that describes the character of the Exodus journey, but also its length. It's a word that can mean according to the number of the days. That's how the word's used in Leviticus 12, verse 2, or 15, verse 25, or Isaiah 23, verse 15, according to the number of the days. And so on that basis, we believe that the words of Micah 7 should be applied to the time period of the second Exodus, which is based on that similar time period which existed in the first. This is going to be a 40-year period, we believe, of wilderness probation. And a similar show of divine power during that Exodus as God tests and proves the house of Israel in the wilderness of the peoples. But our study today brings us to the point where that period of probation is about to come to an end. It's what happens at the finish of the 40 years that we now want to focus our attention on this morning. Well, Brother Thomas has somewhat to say about that in Mystery of the Covenant, because on page 33 he says this: at the end of 40 years' sojourn in the people's wilderness, Elijah conducts the tribes to the borders of the land. So Brother Thomas came to the same conclusion, incidentally, about the 40-year period, and based on the same reading of Micah chapter 7. He'd already worked that out. And what he says now is that the second Exodus will follow the pattern of the first as they march through the wilderness of the peoples for that period of time before finally congregating at what he calls here the borders of the land. Do you know, brothers and sisters, I think it's very hard for us to really imagine the stress and the anxiety of these wandering years. There'll be no doubt all the horrors of previous epochs of time when anti-Semitism resulted in Jewish ghettos, Jewish incarcerations, Jewish pogroms, anti-Jewish propaganda. And yet again, for the Jewish people, to quote Chaim Weizmann, the world will be divided into places where they cannot live and places where they cannot enter. The heart weeps at the thought of what will happen to the house of Israel during this 40 years. The Jews have often been caught in the middle of nowhere. But we need to remember that the purpose of this journey is to turn the hearts of the children to the faith of their fathers until they finally come to trust, really trust, fully trust in Yahweh their God. And that will be what the saints who are working with Elijah will be seeking to achieve as the pastors who work with the house of Israel in all their wanderings. And then notice what Brother Thomas says. He says it would seem that the tribes march from the south toward the Red Sea and from the west, north and east to the Euphrates flood, from which two points they form a junction in the intermediate wilderness. They're gathered from all points of the compass, and having to congregate from such opposite directions, they will no doubt move, fighting their way through the countries and coalescing as occasion may serve until they arrive at their destination. Did you notice that Brother Thomas deliberately introduces now a different term? Did you see it? He calls now something that he describes as the intermediate wilderness, and that's clearly a different place. Whatever the symbolic element might be to the expression the people's wilderness, which may describe a state of things as well as a location, this term, the intermediate wilderness, refers to the physical territories on either side of Israel. And these are going to become the gathering points for the Jews as they return. And his mention of the borders of the land tells us that they're so agonizingly close to the end of their journey now. Just one last push for home. Well, that brings us to the first quotation that Brother Thomas is now going to introduce to us in outlining this last stage of the Odyssey of the House of Israel. And what he does yet again, and perhaps unsurprisingly, is he'll bring together a wonderful set of Bible passages that formed the basis for his thinking and his exposition. One of the things that's so impressive about the writings of Brother Thomas is he's not there to simply expound his own viewpoint on things. He's there to take you back to Scripture, to drive you back to Scripture, to drive you back into what the Scripture says, and to think about Scripture afresh for yourself. He always had a scriptural basis for what he says. And I think he must have been so excited as he pondered these matters. Look, he wrote about this in 1848 in Helpless Israel, but in 1854 he said, I need to have a good look at this again. And I think as he did this and wrote the book, Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land, he was so thrilled to see how these scriptures were woven together as he allowed one passage to call to another until the picture was fully formed. Well, would you like to see what he wove together from Scripture about this last stage of the journey? I would. So shall we do it together? Well, here it is in Isaiah chapter 27. Here's the first of the passages that he drew attention to in talking about the journey through what he's described now as the intermediate wilderness, the last push before they meet Messiah, their king. Now, Isaiah 27, incidentally, is about the return and the purging of Jacob in the future. We know that because, for example, verse 6 says, he shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud. And again, verse 9, by this therefore shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged, and this is all the fruit to take away his sin. This chapter is about the return and purging of Jacob in the future. And the last two verses, which are the verses we want to pay attention to, are therefore set in the context of the final journey into the promised land. All the rebels are purged, and the company that are left are the faithful remnant. And these are the ones that Elijah will now conduct to the very entrance of the land itself. Well, Isaiah 27 verse 12 says, it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off. Now that's an interesting word, because in the Hebrew, chobat, it means to beat out or to thresh. But the sense of the word relates to gleaning a crop in small quantities. It's used of beating out the olive tree in Deuteronomy 24 verse 20. It's used of beating out wheat by hand in Judges 6 verse 11. It's used of beating out barley by hand in Ruth 2 verse 17. And so Brother Thomas actually translates it this way: Yahweh shall make a gathering of his fruit. That's how he translates the word beat off. And that's a very good translation, as the verse will later show. Yahweh shall make a gathering of his fruit. And where will he gather them from? Well, the answer, he says, is from two different directions. Firstly, from the channel of the river. Now that word river in the Hebrew, and you'll know this, is ha nachar, which is generally the word used for the river Euphrates. And we believe it's the river Euphrates that's being referred to in this passage. So this is going to be the assembly or the gathering point to the north of Israel. But also it says from the stream of Egypt. So unto the stream of Egypt is used to indicate that Egypt will be the assembly point for the Jews to the south of Israel. So we've got two assembly points. And verse 12 goes on to say, and ye shall be gathered one by one. And that word gathered is a very similar word to the word beat off at the start of the verse, because the word here, lochat, means to pick up that which is left behind. That is to glean. So it conveys the same ideas as beat out. There is a gathering and a gleaning so that no stragglers are left behind. The divine providence is at work here to make sure that none are lost, and that each individual of the faithful remnant remains, and that they might be brought forward safely on this final step. And so verse 13 goes on to say, and it shall come to pass in that day, says the record, that the great trumpet shall be blown. Now, the margin has a very good cross-reference to Matthew 24. We won't just look it up because I'm going to put it on the screen for you, but it's a good cross-reference for this reason, brothers and sisters, that this is not the trumpet that sounds the call to the resurrection of the saints in the 1st of Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 16. The trumpet of Isaiah 27, verse 13 is the Jubilee trumpet that sounds or proclaims liberty to Israel and calls on them to return to the land of their possession. This is the Jubilee trumpet of return. Now, here it is in Leviticus 25. Then thou shalt cause the trumpet of Jubilee to sound. It shall be a Jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man to his possession. So that's the Jubilee year and the Jubilee trumpet called upon the Jewish people to return back to the land. What an appropriate trumpet to sound here in Isaiah 25. It's found in Isaiah 18 verse 3, which says, see ye when he lifteth up an ensign upon the mountains, and when he bloweth the trumpet, hear ye. Now, we won't look at this, but Isaiah 18 is absolutely a chapter about the destiny of the Jewish nation, a people scattered and peeled. And what the prophet does in 18 verse 3 is he asks the world to see the two great signs that God is at work to recover his people. The witness of the ensign, see ye, is placed among the house of Judah. But the witness of the trumpet, hear ye, is blown before the house of Israel. And this is going to be their call to return. And so now, as we've seen here in Isaiah 27, it shall come to pass that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come that were ready to perish. And they shall come because the trumpet's calling them to return. The people ready to perish, that's the Jewish people en route for Israel as they fight their way home. Now, what do you think the word trumpet might be in each of these three passages? Well, it's the Hebrew word shofar. It's the ram's horn, famous for its sound in calling Israel to their God. It's the word shofar in each of those three places. And now we have the significance of the cross reference in the margin of Isaiah 27, which I'll just put on screen so that we see the connection here. This is Matthew 24, verse 31. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds. Actually, Matthew goes on to say, from the four winds, that is from one end of heaven to the other. Now, the angels in Matthew 24, verse 31, are the saints. And the elect that they are gathering is the house of Israel. And they're going to be regathered from the four winds of heaven. And that's an Old Testament quotation or allusion. That's Zechariah 2 verse 6, when speaking of Israel, it says, "Flee from the land of the north, saith Yahweh, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of heaven." And so the angels that go forth in Matthew 21 are not the angels to collect the saints. They're the saints to collect the Jewish people, the house of Israel. And in that context, the trumpet that's being blown here is the Jubilee trumpet of return. It's another passage, incidentally. Matthew 24 is another passage that shows that there will be saints that go forth with Elijah on his mission. Well, when it says here that the great trumpet shall be blown, that proclamation that the saints will bring in company with Elijah will represent the shofar call to every Jewish community scattered throughout the world. The saints will arrive, and in the message they bring, the Jewish people will hear the sound of their shofar. We're calling you home. And they'll hear that sound from the work and discussion of the saints. And so you see what Isaiah 27 goes on to say now in verse 13. It shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria and the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. So in response to the shofar blast, those of the Jewish people that have the right heart, the faithful remnant now that have been purged, will start this last stage of their journey. But what Isaiah 27 is telling us is that they will begin to congregate at the two opposite ends of the intermediate wilderness, some in Assyria, marked by the river Euphrates, and some in Egypt, marked by the river Nile. And this very geographical description, I think, tells us that the 40 years of probation is now at an end, and the final stage of their journey has arrived. Well, that brings us to Isaiah chapter 11. Because if you come back with me to Isaiah 11, he has somewhat more to say concerning the matter of this last stage. Isaiah 11 says these words in verse 15. And Yahweh shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea. Now, incidentally, the tongue of the Egyptian sea is the bay at the northern extremity of the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. It was in this area that Israel crossed in the first Exodus. And I think what we're being told here, that in the time to come, that marine bay will be physically changed to allow for the crossing of the house of Israel when they arrive at this point in the future. But verse 15 goes on to say, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and smite it in the seven streams and make men to go over dry shod. Now the word river here in verse 15 is the word ha-nahar, which we believe refers to the river Euphrates. He shall smite the river Euphrates into seven streams. And there's a reason for suggesting that, is that when that term, nahar, is used with the definite article, but without any other qualification, it almost always refers to the Euphrates. And secondly, did you notice the effect of smiting this river, verse 15, is so that there might be a highway for his people from Assyria, verse 16. Now, creating a highway from Assyria can only occur when the obstacle of the mighty stream of the Euphrates has been made fordable. So it will be smitten into seven streams, it says, to facilitate the passage of his people. But the language of this intervention in Isaiah 11, verses 15 and 16, is strongly reminiscent of the first Exodus. Because wasn't there a strong east wind in Exodus 14, verse 21? And didn't men walk over dry shod in Exodus 14, verse 29? This is the second Exodus, but it repeats the story of the first. And just as Yahweh showed his power to help his people cross the water in the first Exodus, so he will smite the Euphrates to help Israel, the house of Israel, cross the water in the second Exodus. And so as a result, verse 16 says, "And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt." So the highway runs south from Assyria and north from Egypt, but the purpose of the highway is to convey the returning Jews to their homeland in the center where the two halves of the highway meet. And did you notice the remnant of his people which shall be left? Now that word left, sha'ar, to be left over or to survive, is the same word that was used of the leftovers of the house of Judah in Zechariah chapter 12 verse 14, that will mourn for the pierced one. But now that same word is used to describe the refined remnant, those that are left of the house of Israel. And the implication of these passages is that their God will prepare this way for them as this journey progresses. Well, come with me to Zechariah chapter 10. And so may I just reiterate that in each of these passages that we're currently looking at, this is the string of quotations that Brother Thomas so deftly weaves together in Mystery of the Covenant as he talks about these things. One is astonished at the way in which he's able to just somehow touch his finger on the right place at the right time and connect it to the right other passages. Now just have a look at this one because it's a cracker. In Zechariah chapter 10, it says this in the 8th verse. He says, "I will hiss for them and gather them." Now, that word hiss means to hiss or to whistle, and it's used of a shepherd's pipe that the shepherd would use to summon his sheep from afar. It's used that way in Isaiah 5:26 and Isaiah 7:18. A shepherd's pipe. And the shepherd's pipe that calls the flock in Zechariah 10 verse 8 is really another way of describing the shofar horn that calls his people in Isaiah 27. And so when the time is right, the house of Israel will hear that call. And notice what it says. God doesn't just promise to call them, verse 8. He also promises to redeem them and to increase them, to gather them and to redeem them and to increase them. And so they will hear that call. Just as much as the shofar trumpet, they'll hear the shepherd's pipe. And then verse 9 says, "I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries." Now, the Revised Standard Version reads that a little differently in the start of that verse, and I think it's helpful. The Revised Standard Version says, "Though I have sown them among the people, they shall remember me in far countries." So although Israel were once scattered, the promise of this prophecy is that although sown and scattered abroad, they shall remember, the time will come when they shall remember me in those far countries. And if we were to ask what causes them to remember God, the answer is that the proclamation of the Elijah mission has reached their country. This is Elijah's work. They're going to hear him and remember him. Or notice the key word at the end of the verse that tells us that Elijah's involved. Don't you think? Verse 9. "I'll sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children, and they shall turn again." "I will send you Elijah the prophet," said Malachi, "and he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children." Here it is in Zechariah chapter 10, verse 9. And as a result, verse 10 goes on to say, "And I will bring them again." Where from? Out of the land of Egypt, and gather them out of Assyria. Now, we know that the house of Israel are going to be gathered from all four corners of the earth. So here again, in this verse, it's not saying that Egypt and Assyria are the only places where Jews will return from. What it's saying is that these are the two collection points where they will all assemble to before this last stage of their journey. And in fact, the 10th verse goes on to say, I'll bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them. So the swelling influx of the house of Israel being added to the house of Judah in the land is going to result in an enormous increase in the Jewish population. It'll spread to the east, Gilead, and it'll go to the west, Lebanon, until it's filled up the land. Now, to the best of my knowledge, brothers and sisters, in terms of the current statistics of Jewish population, the worldwide Jewish population today is approximately 16 million. Those in the land, which we define prophetically as the house of Judah, number about 7.5 million. It's about 45%. And those in diaspora, the house of Israel, number about 8.5 million or 55%. So there are still more Jews who live outside the land than live in it. But the birth rate of Jews living in the land is much higher than those living in the diaspora. But I think what we're being told here in Zechariah 10 is when the house of Israel arrives, it will probably more than double the population of the land. And Zechariah 10 verse 10 will come true. They'll spread abroad because of the influx of the house of Israel arriving to join their brethren of the house of Judah. And so verse 11 says, and he shall pass through the sea with affliction. That's interesting. Who do you think the he is? I think it's a reference to God. Yahweh himself, in the person of Elijah and the saints, will travel with his people in crossing the sea of distress. And again, as part of the divine preparation for the journey, God's going to prepare those entry points into the promised land. And this time, the language describes, uses the same two places, but uses the opposite terms to Isaiah, because now it says, he shall smite the waves in the sea. Now, what do you think that sea is? Well, surprisingly, I believe it's a reference to the Euphrates, because the word sea here, which commonly is the word used for the Mediterranean, is also used for large rivers, and it's used of the Euphrates in Isaiah 21 verse 1, but it's used also of the Euphrates in this passage. And I just want you to hear these words, Jeremiah 51 verse 42, which says, the sea is come up upon Babylon, she is covered with the multitude of the waves thereof. The sea has come up, she's covered with the waves. That's the very language here of Zechariah 10 verse 11. So what was the Sea of Babylon? Well, it was the river Euphrates with its canals and lakes and marshes, because every year the Euphrates flooded the whole Mesopotamian plain. It was the sea. Well, all the waves of that sea will be smitten. The Euphrates will be restrained so that God's people might cross over. And then, says Zechariah, all the deeps of the river shall dry up. Ah, but this time the word river is not Nahar. It's the Hebrew word Ya'or, which is the word normally used for the River Nile. So this time, it's about the drying up of the River Nile. So just as the sea of the waves will be smitten, the Euphrates, so the depths of the river will be dried up, the Nile will be reduced so that God's people may pass over. And I think that the taming of the two rivers symbolizes the subduing of the two powers. In fact, when you read Zechariah 10 carefully, you come to that conclusion, don't you think? Let's read it again. He shall pass through the sea, the Euphrates, with affliction and smite the waves of the Euphrates, and all the deeps of the Nile shall dry up. The pride of Assyria, he shall smite the waves in the sea, shall be brought down. And the scepter of Egypt shall depart away, the deeps of the river shall dry up. So in preparation for the movements of the house of Israel, these two powers, as it were, will be humbled. Now think about it. Today, of course, Assyria and Egypt are not places or countries of significance. But in the prophet's day, they were. They were the superpowers of the age. A power grouping to the north and a power grouping to the south of Israel Well, don't you think those two power groups will be present at the time of the end in the form of the king of the north and the king of the south? And both those alliances will be humbled as part of God's clearing of the way for his people to return. And so verse 12 says, I will strengthen them in Yahweh, and they shall walk up and down in his name, saith Yahweh. To walk up and down, of course, is a reference to the house of Israel, journeying throughout the earth as they will have been for the previous 40 years. But the thing is, as the prophet says, they will have journeyed in God's name, and they will be strengthened at every step of the way with his providential hand to lead them on to Zion. Well, that brings us to Isaiah chapter 19. And Isaiah 19 furnishes just one or two other highly useful details about the story of this last stage of their journey. Isaiah chapter 19 and verse 23, it goes on to say these words. It says, in that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. Now, notice it says the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and presumably, therefore, the Egyptian shall come into Assyria. This is a literal highway, and it's going to be used from both ends to facilitate the movement of people. The Assyrian will come down the highway, and the Egyptian will come up the highway. But now the purpose of the highway is made clear, verse 24. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria. Do you know, at first sight, that statement sounds rather surprising, doesn't it? Israel shall be the third? Surely we'd expect Israel to be the first, not just the third. And certainly not the third as in third equal with Egypt and Assyria. But that's not what the phrase means. And the context supplies the proper interpretation. It says Israel shall be the third, even a blessing in the midst of the land. So Egypt and Assyria represent the rest of the world, grouped around Israel, which will become the intermediary between the nations. So far from suggesting that Egypt and Assyria will have equality with Israel, it teaches Israel's supremacy. They're at the center of it all. They're the third, even the blessing in the midst of the land. And by means of this highway, all nations sweep into the center to converge upon the third part, Israel, who rules in the midst. Because we're expressly told, did you notice that Egypt and Assyria will be in servitude, verse 23, and that's as a result of their power being broken, Zechariah chapter 10, verse 11. And verse 25 goes on to say, whom Yahweh of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance. And so as we saw last evening, as part of the sheep nations accepted into the kingdom, Egypt and Assyria will be recognized for their new relationship with God. But here's the thing, brothers and sisters, only Israel can ever be described as Yahweh's inheritance. That's Deuteronomy 32 verse 9. For Yahweh's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. You see, their relationship with him is unique. So what we've got is a wonderful collection of passages here that all speak about the journey of the house of Israel through the intermediate wilderness. I think it's helpful, though, for us to see the geography, because the geography helps us, leads us to perhaps several conclusions. This is the highway home to Israel, and as we look at it in a geographical context and try to think about what these prophets have told us, well, just see what we can conclude. So to the north is Assyria, and to the south is Egypt. And if we were to ask why Assyria and why Egypt, it's because they are being used to represent the entire world from opposite directions in relation to Israel. Israel lies at the center as the third part in the midst of the land. And in fact, what we're being told is that every nation in the world ultimately will consider to be either north or south of the Holy Land, because Israel will be the point from which the location of every nation is identified. Israel lies at the center of it all. But the geography of the region tells us something else. Because you see, to the north lies the river Euphrates. And to the south lies the river Nile. And what that means is that when the Jews of the house of Israel arrive at these two places, they must all participate in an act of national baptism in order to continue their journey. They've got to cross the rivers. And I think that that actually was anticipated by the prophet. There's a passage in Isaiah 51 that says this, verses 9 to 11. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it which dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, that hath made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? Therefore, the redeemed of Yahweh shall return and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their head. And I think the implication is that in the second Exodus, there will be another journey through the depths of the sea, and that God has selected the very topography of this region so that the principle of national baptism might be reenacted. Even the land is designed so that God's message can be proclaimed. From the beginning, it was always so. And you see, what's interesting is, for those crossing from Assyria, they will memorialize the crossing over of Abraham. But for those crossing from Egypt, they will memorialize the Exodus under Moses. And did you notice that the boundaries that are shown here are not just Assyria and Egypt, but specifically the river Euphrates and the river Nile, both of which are referred to in these passages about the highway. But don't you think those places are significant? Because listen to these words in Genesis 15, verse 18. In the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, unto from the river of Egypt, the Nile, unto the great river, the river Euphrates. So these rivers define the dimensions of the land promised to Abraham. So the moment they cross the rivers at either side, they've already entered the land of promise. When they enter the highway, the intermediate wilderness, it's a sign that their probation in the wilderness of the peoples is over. Now, it's interesting because I think there's a tendency to spiritualize these prophecies of the highway. In fact, Christianity teaches that the highway is the path of the church. But the reality is that the house of Israel is literally saved from their literal enemies, and they literally return to the land on a literal highway. You can't have a spiritual type without a natural. You can't have a symbolic highway without a real one. It might symbolize the way of the truth, but the primary application, we believe, of these prophecies is to the physical highway that will be built for the house of Israel. It's a real road. It's built for real people. They're called Israel, and it's built for them to travel on. And just look how specific the prophet was about this extraordinary road that will sweep through the desert, built, by the way, under the superintendence of Christ. Because remember, he's got 40 years to do this. There'll be one group of people building the temple for 40 years and another group building this road under the orders of Christ, so that when the house of Israel finally arrive at these destinations 40 years later, this road, this highway is ready for them. And what the Bible says, what Isaiah the prophet says, is this area, this highway, is grassed, Isaiah 35 verse 7. It's separated, Isaiah 35 verse 8. It's protected, Isaiah 35 verse 9. It's straight, Isaiah 40 verse 3. It's level, Isaiah 62 verse 10. It's elevated, Isaiah 62 verse 10. This highway is all organized for what it needs to do when the house of Israel come. And I'll tell you why. Maybe I'll just put something else on the slide before I make this comment. There's key references to the highway and the fact that Egypt and Assyria are the two entrance points. Why this such massive detail on this highway? Well, because although we're not sure how many of the house of Israel will finally make it to these two points after purging, There's 8.5 million Jews out in the world waiting to be called home. And at least several million of those are going to have to travel on this road to get to Israel. It's built for them. Actually, do you remember the words of one of our hymns? I think maybe this hymn comes to light with that chart. Hail to the brightness of Zion's glad morning, long by the prophets of Israel foretold. Hail to the millions from bondage returning. Gentiles and Jews the glad vision behold. Lo, in the desert, rich flowers are springing. Streams ever copious are gliding along. Loud from the mountaintops echoes are ringing. Wastes rise in verdure and mingle in song. That hymn, brothers and sisters, is about the house of Israel coming home on the highway. These are all aspects of the literal highway upon which the returning Israelites will walk. And as part of that, and as that hymn suggests, in the providence of God, there'll be water in the wilderness. Water in the wilderness. Water in the wilderness. God's abiding love and care for his people will be on this journey. The purging is now complete. The blessings can commence. But what a stupendous work this will be. The desert will be transformed, and so will their own hearts and minds. Because that whole tract of land between the Euphrates and the Nile has always been desolate and arid, but all just waiting for this day. And where there's water, there will be growth. And if there's growth, there will be food, and the wilderness will become a fruitful field. Can you just imagine the joy of different branches of the families from the house of Israel meeting up on the highway and comparing experiences with other parts of their families and knowing that they're almost at journey's end? This is the highway of return. It says this in Isaiah 11, verse 16. There shall be an highway for his people. Now you see that word highway, mesila, in the Hebrew. It's a very interesting word because it actually means a thoroughfare as turnpiked. I don't know if you've got turnpikes in America, but it refers to a road on which a toll is collected at a toll gate. So this isn't a road that just anyone can travel on. Only those who've paid the toll can enter the highway and begin their journey. And for this road, the toll will be paid by entering the waters of baptism to acknowledge the righteousness of God. This is a highway that the remnant of God's people will travel on. Isn't that Isaiah 40 verse 3? The voice of him that crieth, in the wilderness prepare ye the way of Yahweh, make straight in the desert a highway, a mesila, for our God. Now we know that prophecy, of course, Isaiah 40, is quoted in the Gospels, remember, and applied to John the Baptist, concerning he who was the messenger to the house of Judah. But the ultimate outworking of the prophecy, don't you think, clearly refers to Elijah coming to the house of Israel and bringing them back on this highway. Isaiah 62 says, go through the gates, prepare the way, cast up the highway, the mesila. Lift up a standard, gather out the stones. And that word highway here is a road, when it says cast up, it's a road that is built that's deliberately higher than the adjacent ground. It's similar to the Roman roads that were built elevated and with a slight curvature on it so that the water would always run off the road and it would never be waterlogged so that people could always march freely on that road. That's how this highway will be built. And the gathering out of all the stones means that the highway is not only raised above the ground, but it's level and even, so a multitude can travel on it in safety. Our best English word to describe that would be a causeway. It's a causeway that they travel on, lifted up in the midst of the desert. And likewise, Jeremiah 31 speaks of that same causeway that they will travel on, signposted so that no one can ever get lost. Well, that brings us to Isaiah 35. Let's just come now to Isaiah 35. And I'm just going to skip through that slide there. And come to Isaiah 35. It says in Isaiah 35, verse 1, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. Now, we sing our hymn, don't we? A rose shall bloom in the lonely place. A wild shall echo with sounds of joy. The ransomed of God shall return to him with a chorus of joy to a gladsome lay. And we sing these words, that's us on the way to the kingdom. And so it is, brothers and sisters, but that's not the primary meaning of those words in Isaiah 35. That hymn and this chapter is about the house of Israel traveling on the highway with Elijah and the saints. And when we sing that hymn, we should feel the pull of the hope of Israel on us in asking our God that he will bring his people home as he's promised in this place. And so verse 8 of Isaiah 35 says, "And an highway shall be there, and it shall be called a way of holiness, and the unclean shall not pass over." So one of the aspects of this highway is that it will be protected from any unauthorized travelers. There'll be no threat to Israel from either the unholy or the scornful or the profane, because at this point this road is reserved for their use. But it shall be for those, the wayfaring men. Now the King James Version is slightly uncertain, but Rodham says, there shall not pass over it one who's unclean, but he himself shall be one of them travelling the road, and the perverse shall not stray therein. That reading is supported by the margin. He shall be with them. So Yahweh will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your reward. We're told here that Israel will be accompanied on this journey by their God, who's represented by Elijah and the saints. Now, do you know, brothers and sisters, Isaiah 19 tells us that this highway will be used by others during the millennial age. I think this is the road that the nations will travel on themselves when they come up to worship the king. And there's a tremendous lesson here when you think about it, because the nations in the future, those who desire salvation, have got to walk on the highway of Israel. You couldn't have a more powerful way of impressing the world with the truth that Israel is the head of the nations. If you wish to go to Jerusalem and worship the king, you've got to walk on Israel's road. Only Israel has the way of the truth. All the world will have to learn that, and they'll walk on that road to learn it. Well, we're on that way now, brothers and sisters. Not a literal highway, but the way of the truth. And if we want to demonstrate to the house of Israel how to walk on that way, we need to have learned to walk in the straight way today. The straight way, the straight way, the straight way, the straight way. If we want to be pastors to the house of Israel about this is the way, walk ye in it, we need to learn about walking in the straight way. You know, the funny thing about human nature, brothers and sisters, is it always wants to turn to the right or the left just to see what lies off the path. The way of the truth is worn the most at the edges. Walking down the centre line requires three things of us: focus, balance, and momentum. But that's what we're asked to do. And the best way to walk the straight path is for our eyes to look right on. So what's the one thing, do you think, that we could do to help us each day to walk a straighter line to the kingdom? I think the answer is we need to read the word every day. Even if we don't completely understand the meaning of our daily portion, what the word does is it shines a spotlight on the center line. What the word does is remind us every day of the difference between good and evil, between holy and profane, between right and wrong, and we need that. Well, what a journey that will be, brothers and sisters, for the house of Israel when they travel on that highway. But at some point, they've got to come off the highway, cross the Jordan River, and come face to face with the house of Judah that are already in the land. Now those two terms, the house of Judah and the house of Israel, actually don't just indicate a difference between those in the land and those outside. They refer to a spirit of rivalry and hostility, because Israel and Judah were ancient foes who fought each other. It's a funny thing, but even in the world today, Jews living outside are often highly critical of what the Jews living in the land get up to. So how will those deep divisions between Judah and Israel be healed? What circumstances might bring about such a transformation that the Jewish nation is finally reorganized into a single entity and reinstated as the 12 true tribes of ancient times? Well, that, God willing, as it happens, is the substance of our final study.